Blood for Wildflowers by Donnie Goodman. Narrated by Rain Corbin. Manifest Destiny Hymn 214. There are two things in this life of which I am certain. Wildflowers love blood, and dead men don't sing no songs. When I put the barrel of my revolver in their mouths and they lick the taste of oblivion, the unmistakable blend of stainless steel, sulfur, and charred meat, they are liable to come up with all sorts of melodies to try and please my ears. I've been sung many of these tunes over the years, disgusting cries of prayer through tears and snot. But I ain't a religious man, so hymns get silenced as quick as my draw. Their bodies left to provide communion for the fields. I don't ever worry about killing no man. Once you cross a certain moral demarcation, the act ceases to boil the acid in the pit of one's stomach. For me, it started as a need to survive a series of skirmishes in the Arapaho region, but things changed when I deserted nobility in order to pursue, shall we say, more prosperous activities. At some point, killing became fun. And until I'm on the other side of that barrel, I'm here to have a good time. 3 days ago, I heard a song that piqued my interest. My associate, Juan, had been tasked with flagging Pony Express riders heading towards Westport, and he up and rose hell at our camp, hollering about a baked horse blazing back trails. So we hastily packed up and intercepted the poor delivery man as his horse took water at the mouth of the basin in Keene's Hollow. You never know what information these folks are carrying, but even if it's nothing of value, the soil sure won't complain about the nourishment from a fresh keel, and our debts must be paid one way or another. I let Red Mountain work him over first, because I love to watch him do this trick where he peels off the big toenail with a hot knife and salts the exposed tissue like a skewered rabbit. It's damn near the funniest thing I have ever seen, but it is mighty effective at getting these mail boys to adjudicate their loyalty to their employers and reveal what they are hiding. And trust me, everyone is hiding something. I'm the only literate one, so I always have the pleasure of digging through whatever we find first. The majority of the letters contain frivolous correspondence, but I fancied a fair share of the hauls. Love poems from New York politicians to whores out in Fort Lansdale. Bank statements for potential marks. And thanks to this most recent and unfortunate carrier, a mysterious map with a set of coordinates and a date. Under the menacing light of his campfire, I removed my bandana and revealed my disfigurements, the basis of my identity and reputation. And oh, how that mail boy sang. So pretty. An angel descending from the heavens to show Billy the face marshal, the hollow space hidden in his saddlebags, the inscribed parchment paper closed by an obsidian wax seal, which signified wealth of unimaginable proportion. He begged and pleaded for his life, but I cut him off to tell him that men venture out this way to find gold, oil, and whatever they can get their greedy little hands on, but most find nothing but death. I am the reminder of that fortune. I shot his exhausted horse first, a gracious act of mercy. I have no respect for any man who takes advantage of the stamina of these marvelous animals, so we stayed up late and carved him up slow. Red Mountain scavenged some herbs from a nearby grove and cooked his legs for us. Benny played harmonica. Gwen cleaned her rifles. Juan fed worms to a crow he kept in his breast pocket, nursing its broken wing in between our misadventures. We had many miles to travel and only 2 days to move, but sometimes you need to savor the pleasures of the present. You can't enjoy anything if you're constantly focused on the horizon. I slept better that night than I had in years, dreaming about what we would find at the location marked on the letter. At dawn, we rode for the valley beyond the limestone and shale-striped bluffs to stock up on provisions. Layman's Rest, a small mining town, offered a promising bevy of hedonistic activities, and we hadn't slept in beds in weeks, for it had grown risky to venture towards settlements. We had already put down 3 separate groups of well-financed bounty hunters, lawmen and gunslingers attempting to test my right hand. But every once in a while, an appearance in civilization was necessary. Most folks left us alone and kept to themselves, which was the intelligent, if impolite, thing to do. But I like to dispel the notion that our gang was a myth. We were, in fact, very real. As we hit the switchback, Benny was the first to notice a new building had been erected down the trail, a small but ornate single-room church. My curiosity led me to hitch Checkers, my prized Appaloosa, to a small pine adjacent to the structure, while my companions stood guard. I entered to find a single pastor mid-sermon. 10 rows of pews sat empty, apart from one vagabond who slipped in and out of consciousness, hiccuping into an empty jug of spirits. Enraptured by the intensity of his own oration, the preacher in a fancy white suit did not acknowledge my presence. So I took a seat and crossed my legs as he painted a picture of a savage world that needed to be tamed. He claimed that God had given him the directions to build an army of disciples that would cleanse the frontier of sin. I loudly snorted at this assertion, which caused him to open his eyes, and I mean really open his eyes, maybe for the first time in his life. He backed up from the pathetically small pulpit and grimaced at the sight of my less than handsome features. I smiled, lit a cigarette, and let the smoke waft through the cavities that pocked the landscape of my face. He asked if I was there to find God, and I shook my head no. I said he wouldn't enjoy my company very much, and I despised the notion of manifest destiny. I asked the pastor if he thought it was fated for our paths to cross that morning, and before he had the chance to answer, I stood up and brought my finger to my lips to quiet him. I told him I once heard a story about a man that drank so much gin he ignited in the candlelight of his bedroom, and I wanted to test the theory. He looked confused, then afraid, as I flicked the cigarette towards the sleeping man on the pew, and sure enough, eureka! The putrid skin of the drunk burst into flames as if he was doused with kerosene. Both men screamed. I silenced them with two quick shots and exited the church as flame tongues licked north towards its cross. The only thing we are destined for is death. Hundreds of decomposing buffalo carcasses littered the remainder of the trail to Layman's Rest. Our horses slowed, trotting through a sludge of innards and detritus, which gave birth to an orchestra of buzzing insects. We mourned for the bison and for our timing. If we had come upon the riflemen mid-slaughter, oh, the pain we could have inflicted! The thick swarms clouded our vision for a mile or so before we emerged at the wooden sign indicating we had arrived. The word spread, hastily. Pedestrians scattered, uttering moans of angst as they disappeared into the various establishments lining the red clay road which split the growing settlement into two sections. A few curious children hid behind a water trough and observed as we dismounted and hitched our horses to the posts lining the general store. It didn't take long for Sheriff Rogers, the phantasm of order, to appear. He gazed at us in contemplation before asking about the nature of our business there. I told him our general nature was skewed towards pleasure. His attempt at intimidation was commendable, almost as earnest as a stage actor in Manhattan. I continued the exchange, letting him know that we were there for one night and planned on putting our hard-earned currency into the waiting hands of his many proprietors. My performance was just as earnest. The lawman was short-staffed and in no shape to take us on, despite the bounty and fame it would surely land him. So he made the wise decision to grant us entry and leave us be. Red Mountain entered the store for provisions and ammo. Juan moved toward the dentist to find medicine for his crow. Benny made for a three-card Monty game. Gwen chased a giggling whore up a flight of wooden stairs at the inn, and I decided to have myself a drink. Attack Pianist scored my entry to the saloon. Upon the realization of my likely unwanted company, the patrons around the barman dissipated, allowing me to take a seat on a wooden stool that did nothing to appease my desire for comfort. I tossed him a Morgan and requested bourbon. He popped the cork from a resplendent bottle from the top shelf that smelled of fine oak. True craftsmanship. I pulled my bandana down, threw back the generous pour, and tapped the counter for another, when a burst of laughter disturbed my imbibement. I could smell the bastard before I saw him. A thin, wiry dolt caked in dry manure and carrion. The personification of rot gut. I didn't need to see the long-barreled rifle slung across his shoulders to recognize the man's penchant for culling bison. He raised a mug of Glasgow ale into the air and slurred a request for me to join his table. I obliged. The pianist continued to play, and the conversations around us picked back up. But I was clearly center stage, and my current and future actions would provide the stories that would surely emerge around the next campfire. The thin man said he knew all about me, and it was an honor to be in my presence. I told him I could not say the same for him. He burped, then laughed at my sharp tongue. He inquired if he could pay for my next round. I declined. I asked him if he liked the taste of glass, and he paused to think about what that meant, but he was far too drunk to understand the situation he had talked himself into. I gripped my right hand around his mug and brought it down onto his fingers. Before he could yelp, I brought it down again, this time into the center of his forehead. He collapsed backwards onto the wooden planks of the floor, and I continued to work the mug into the soft parts of his face. His teeth shattered, clinking over the melody of the piano in a harmony I found amusing. I continued, refusing to pause to admire my work. His features collapsed inward into a crimson pool of fragmented humanity and fractured bone shards. He was truly disgusting in both life and death. I tossed the barman another Morgan and requested the services of the bathhouse. There is no sin that cannot be washed away by a helping of good whiskey and a hot bath. I immediately forgot all about the horrible thin man as the near scalding water cleansed my skin of its impurities. I had a spell to myself before the bathmaid entered the room and prepared to work on my shoulders, but I waved her off. She said her name was Sally, and she was there to help me however she could. She wore a black and red corset, which accentuated her remarkable physical gifts, but I had no interest in the pleasures she was forced to offer. So she sat on the stool next to me and hummed a sultry tune. I asked her how long she had been living in the area, and she replied, "Too long." I took the opportunity to have her fetch the map from the breast pocket of my coat. Her eyes lit up. She asked if we were looking for buried treasure with a molasses-like coating of sarcasm. I laughed and replied, "Something like that," and proceeded to inquire what she knew about the coordinates listed on the inscription. I read the markings out loud. Longitudinal and latitudinal numbers, a time, a date. She was tickled by the notion that she was some sort of explorer, but the sketches of elm trees across the parchment put her in a state of reflection. She said there was a grove about 15 miles northeast, where we might find what we were looking for. I thanked her for the information and was ready to send her away when she asked if she could touch my face. Normally, this sort of conversational deviation would offend my sense of decorum, but I was appreciative of her polite tone, so I nodded my head in agreement. She caressed the indentation scattered along my jaw and moaned in a way that indicated she was more akin to our gang than I had anticipated. She brought her opposite hand down between her legs and worked herself into a furious rhapsody. I did not question the authenticity of her performance. When she finished, she walked over to a wooden chest and retrieved a small tincture of laudanum. She helped herself, then offered me the spoon. I was wrong. There were some pleasures to be had here after all. I woke to an eruption of gunfire. I was admittedly still under the effects of Sally's serum and unable to fully gather my intellect before Juan came charging into my room at the inn. He said Benny was dead. I could hear Gwen return shots with her repeater from a nearby window. Some of them struck flesh, for I heard the strangers sing. I gathered my belongings and made sure my revolver was full, and we proceeded to move downstairs towards our horses. Red Mountain got to work unhitching them, while Juan covered him with a few bullets propelled into the endless night of layman's rest. I spent a moment working to gain a sense of what we were dealing with. It became clear that at some point, Sheriff Rogers had grown confident with his trigger finger. He had also grown a posse of prospectors large enough to give him the comfort to begin this cowardly assault. Benny was a degenerate gambler, but he was loyal and strong. His absence would be hard to replace. I had no time left to think about the impact of his death, as our total survival was currently in question. I picked off two men with two well-placed shots and directed everyone to ride north. I mounted checkers as a lead ball skimmed the top of my right ear. Juan wasn't as lucky. I heard the slug enter his lower back, a whistling sound followed by a wet thud. He cried out in pain, but we stayed together and moved towards the exit of town, past a noose where Benny's corpse dangled in the warm wind. The posse did not give chase. It appeared they would celebrate the bounty of our muscles' untimely demise and use this moment to build the credibility of their lawman. It didn't matter to me none. I've always found that life holds many more interesting cards than the ones we had been dealt in layman's rest. We rode in stride for a few hours while Juan whimpered in excruciating pain. I let them know that the timing of our travels could not have been more perfect, despite the rough patch we had just ventured through. I wouldn't tell anyone I said a prayer, but I certainly felt hope that Sally's intuition and my gut instincts would lead us in the correct direction. After a few hours of travel, this hope proved to have been placed on the correct plane of our existence. We slowed our approach when the rays of torchlights reflected into our eyes from a grove of elm trees in the distance. Once we caught sight of the waiting party, we dismounted, reloaded, and ventured on foot to a rocky slope which was elevated above what became clear was an obsidian stagecoach and three large men in elegant three-piece suits. Red Mountain signaled for a flanking formation, and I agreed with his tactical assessment. Gwen took a spot along the top of the rocks and steadied her rifle, while Juan sat back and watched, doing his best to nurse the wound on his back and keep quiet. I always loved watching Red Mountain in these moments. He made no sounds at all. He circled the men in suits along their right side as I brought my hand up for Gwen to see. As I brought it down, I heard her shot, and as always, her aim was true. By the time I heard the second shot, Red Mountain had tossed a sharpened blade into the neck of one of the men and rushed over to drive it through to its exit point. As the man fell, he begged for us to find Silas Fisk. Then he expired. There was an echo from the ricochet of Gwen's second bullet, followed by total silence. We gathered at the base of the stagecoach. We had no notions of what was inside, but it was damn near impossible to open its hatch to find out. I considered searching the dead men for a key when Red Mountain fetched a stick of dynamite from his satchel. We laughed at the excessive nature of his solution, but after a few careful incisions and some work with a makeshift fuse, we adjusted the explosive material into a form that would satisfy our need to enter. Gwen sparked a match. The combustion and resulting concussion solved our problem. The hardwood splintered into submission, leaving an entry point into the velvet-lined interior of the vehicle. I wasn't sure what to expect, but it certainly wasn't what ended up being inside. A velvet satchel containing a 12-inch doll of a wooden horse. It was some kind of child's toy. I removed the object to show them when Juan's crow emerged from his pocket, cawed loudly, and miraculously flew away into the approaching dawn. This omen caused Red Mountain to climb upon his horse and flee in the opposite direction. At this moment, I may have said a prayer. We waited for an hour or so, but Red Mountain never returned. Juan continued to whimper while Gwen grew anxious by the strange nature of our companion's departure. She said nothing about it made sense, and while I tended to agree with her assessment, we were running out of options. We pushed into the woods for a few miles and broke ground for a campsite. I fetched kindling for a fire while Gwen tended to Juan's back. The whole time, I stroked the hair of the doll. Juan's wound was worse than we first anticipated. He was already low in spirit from the unceremonious departure of his crow, but I was sure he would beat the incoming fever and help us get back to a place where we could regroup and reorganize. Gwen asked me what happened to the doll. I told her it was with me, and she didn't seem to like that revelation. She asked me to get rid of it, and I declined. We heard a branch snap. I drew my revolver to find the light of our campfire reflecting off of the irises of two large eyes, then four, then six. A family of grizzly bears circled us. Juan cried out in fear, his wounds smelling of necrosis, but they did not descend on him. They just sat and watched us. A man called out from behind the bears and cried hello. I was not sure how to respond to the strange utterance, so I replied back with a greeting. He introduced himself as Silas and apologized for the intrusion on our camp. I could sense Gwen wrapping a finger around her rifle, so I removed my bandana and threw her a stern look. Silas said the men we killed in the grove were there to give him something, and he was there to see it disposed of safely. He said he had traveled for miles with Hank, his bear, and they helped people get rid of evil things. He asked if we had touched what was in the stagecoach, and I reluctantly confirmed. I held the doll in my hands and brushed its hair. Gwen let out a soft cry. We heard a crunching sound behind us. It is hard to describe what happened next. In the light of the fire, I could see the roots at the base of the tree pull Juan into the earth. He did not go smoothly, however. His body was constricted into six or seven sections, his bones snapping gratuitously at each point of entry to the soil. Gwen turned to run, but a tree grabbed her and pulled her apart in one swift tug of its thick branches. The fire was snuffed out. I heard the coals sizzle from the introduction of her entrails. Silas said he was sorry. There was nothing he could do. He would close off the grove for future passers-by and leave a marker for the order. At this point, I laughed as the ground around me shifted. I had spent so long imagining how I would reach this moment, the person I'd greet before finding death. None of this was anything I could have imagined, and for that, I guess I was happy. I was Billy the Face Marshall, and as the roots emerged from the earth and circled around my body, I took solace in the knowledge that I was finally blood for wildflowers. I sang.